Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 28th, 2004. Today's session number is CAM 2004-03. Today's speakers are Mary Carlson and Dan Spencer. The lesson for today is Bioethics as Vocation, Our Bodies, Our Faith, Organ Donor and Scarce Resources. Let's listen in.
Ask whether anybody here is the first time. I don't think so, as I look.
We got one here.
Okay, all right, well, welcome. And welcome back to the rest of you. Today we're focusing our cases, we did an earlier one at 7:30, on organ donation, organ transplantation. First, what I'd like to do, however, is acknowledge that there's a large group here from a congregation in Deerwood, Minnesota. Any of you from that group? Who are, as I understand it, praying in a vigil today, half-hour segments, for a young man from the congregation named Adam, who is this morning undergoing a stem cell transplant. So we would like to honor Adam and start for 1 minute in some silent prayer, and then do you mind ending us as you did this morning? That would be great. So let's say a prayer for Adam as we get started, please.
Gracious God, for Adam's life, for his family, for his community, for his caregivers, we give you thanks and ask for blessing.
Amen. Okay, before we get into the organ donation material, Dan was going to bring us up to speed on yesterday's survey of tally of where people were on the options for end of life.
We have we got permission from the village to make some photocopies of some of the things that we have on the board here. So if you find it helpful to have handouts, we'll make these available and just send these around. The one that is going around right now is this ethical options at the end stages of life.
No, it's not.
That. The one? Whoops. Okay, the one that will be going around shortly. Is But you'll want that one too. The six-step model is really good.
Sorry about that. Some things we practice, some things we don't.
If you were here yesterday.
Please leave it on the table at the end.
And we have other handouts up in front here that correlate to some of the other newsprint things. So if you find them helpful, stop by and pick some up, some previous case studies, so forth. You recall yesterday we were looking at what are the ethical issues around end-of-life concerns that come up, both withholding and withdrawing treatment, but especially the question of physician-assisted suicide. Is it ever ethical to facilitate death, to bring about death intentionally, and is it ethical for a physician to participate in that? And at the very end, but over the spectrum from a strong sanctity of life perspective, it says the most important ethical consideration is that life is sacred and we should do whatever necessary to preserve life. To a more quality of life perspective that argues that at certain points life can become so impaired in its quality that it impairs the dignity of the person, and therefore we should give the autonomy, respect the autonomy of the individual if she or he no longer wants to live. Now, the first three here are strong in the sanctity of life perspective, and I just listed here where we came out as a group there, as well as a few other groups that I've done this year. You'll notice that five people who filled out there are in the stronger in the sanctity of life perspective, that one should not withdraw treatment as long as a person is living. Two people said never withdraw treatment from a non-dying patient. But meaning if a person is terminal, is dying, then you can withdraw treatment, make them comfortable, let them die. But if they're not dying, we should continue to treat. Three of you saw that it is important to never withdraw or abate nutrition or hydration, that food and water is a basic human right that everyone should have in that situation. But the bulk of our group clusters around positions 4 and 5, which is very reflective of where American society is in general as well. 19 of you favor the current legal consensus, which is you may withdraw or abate or end life-sustaining treatment when it's warranted, so-called passive euthanasia, withholding or withdrawing to allow a patient to die. And in most places, that's a legal alternative now.
Anna's case.
Anna's case would be an example of that, where the family was given the option. 21 of you went to the position that we looked at yesterday that would allow that, but take it one step further and allow physician-assisted suicide as a legal and ethical alternative. And 7 of you went further and said, in addition to physician-assisted suicide, there may be rare cases when voluntary active euthanasia, when someone else besides the patient administers the means of death there as a rare exception. Nobody in the group thought we should go to the full quality of life, that every individual has the right to determine how and when they die and have assistance in that. Now, I just put up here, just so you get a little snapshot of where some of the other groups, I've been teaching contemporary ethics at Drake University for a number of years, and I always poll my classes. So you can see a couple different groups here from the spring of 98 and spring of 2002. In the spring of 98, I had quite a few students, 13 out of about 45 or so, who were strongly in the sanctity of life perspective. The dominant position in that group was the number 4, the current consensus here. And I only had 6 that spring who were in favor of physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. But 4 years later, you see I had a good spread here in this area here, but the dominant position by far was in favor of physician-assisted suicide. And I haven't been able to detect any strong pattern of this. I've done this with several different classes there. It comes all over the map there. This group here, this third column here, is I participated on the Iowa Methodist Medical Center Bioethics Committee for a number of years, and we polled ourselves as an ethics committee. And you can see that the majority, the majority position, the main position was number 4, but 10 of us also were in the more quality of life perspective, only one in the strong sanctity of life perspective in that particular situation. So you can just see the kind of range of different things. So I mentioned before, polls from the 50s and the 60s would have put the majority of folks in the sanctity of life. Societal opinion and legal opinion has been moving more towards greater patient autonomy, greater quality of life considerations. And so the current Oregon position is number 5, the national position overall is number 4.
The last point you made this morning was that all 7 of these assume autonomy. None of these are about involuntary ending of life. Okay, so that's important to recall. That isn't even considered an option. We just go out and end people's life if they don't want us to. Other than war, as somebody said the other day.
Yeah.
But that's okay. We decided that we couldn't spend more time on that today because we always run out of time, particularly in this class, as does Dan when he teaches. So I'm just going to give us a bit of context about organ donation. Why do you think we pick organ donation as an important area of biomedical ethics to talk about? What makes it important?
There are only so many organs.
There are only so many organs.
And then we all need them.
And many of us need them. Okay? That's basically it. We're talking about an arena of scarcity that matters. And it's getting to matter even more. And we'll get into that. So, somebody else says it's expensive.
Very expensive.
And it's expensive.
So when we talk about scarce resources, are we allocating them appropriately?
So like throughout the week, when we talk about individual cases becoming important fodder for public policy, organ donation probably illustrates that as well as or better than in. And as Mary brought up in the earlier session, this also can be carried into the international arena, like much of our healthcare ethics can be, but we can get some specific situations going with organ donation too, which can come up in just a bit. Let me talk just a little bit about some data for context, so that we know a little bit more before we get right into the case. One is that my closest friend is the executive director of LifeSource, which is the Upper Midwest organ sharing organization. So there are, I think, 5 in the nation. And these are the UNOS organizations that are in charge of overseeing all organ procurement and transplantation programs. So I got a lot of this data from her just before I came up. In 2004 now, there are about 86,000 people on waiting lists for any organ. So that's all kinds of organs. About 18 people a day die waiting on the list for an organ. And that compares to 1996 when we taught, it was between 8 and 10 dying a day. So more people are dying. Now we certainly have a bigger population in the U.S. as well. So.
And there were under 50,000 on the wait list.
And under 50,000 on the wait list in 96. Yeah. So what we're seeing is increasing shortage. Both the need and the availability are going, but the shortage is increasing. And it's pushing a number of parameters in policy and in ethics about organ donation. One is, ought we be taking more living donor organs instead of cadavers only, and that is organs procured from people who have already suffered cardiac or brain death. We're doing much more of that, lung, liver, pancreas, and very commonly kidney. Our case study this morning was about a living liver donation. We're using more marginal donors. Susan told me that we might take cadaver livers from people over 70 years old. We don't do it over 80 yet. But 10 years ago, there's no way we would have done it probably over people over 50 or 60. So we're using, quote, more marginal donors in some situations. We're pushing always the conversation about financial incentives. At this point, it is illegal for anyone to profit by donating an organ in our country. I'll leave it at that at the moment. Kidneys cost the recipient between $50,000 and $75,000, depending on where you are in the country. That is only the in-hospital costs of the transplant. It is not pre-hospital costs, it is not post-hospital costs, and it is only the medical costs. It's not all the other holistic costs that we take into consideration. That is a liver, $150,000 to $200,000 for the recipient. And also this doesn't talk about cost for the donor. There are three primary criteria on the waiting list that are important when we talk about who gets what organs. Obviously, the medical match, blood type, the antigens, all the other medical stuff that I'm not expert in has to work for a transplantation to occur. Length of time on the waiting list is a criteria, but increasingly the criteria of how ill somebody is and the degree of risk of their dying while on the list takes precedent over how long you've been on the list. Imagine the issues involved with who gets what. They're enormous issues with them. We have increased bridge technologies, that is the possibilities technologically of keeping people going while they're waiting. And depending on which organ they're waiting for, we can do it better. And I'm, again, not expert on all those technologies, just to know that's pushing us. Because more people are able to live longer waiting for organs, which increases the demand for organs as well.
And decreases the cost involved. I mean, you're talking about a huge outlay of resources of keeping people alive and folks
while they're waiting. Organs. Exactly. And then coverage questions are evolving all the time. Susan said generally Medicare covers organ donations. So people on Medicare, 65 or over, or people who are disabled and have Medicare, can get most organ transplantation covered. Medical assistance, which is welfare across the country, generally follows the Medicare guidelines for coverage. However, it varies a great deal state by state because welfare is a state decision how much to fund for people within our own state. And therefore, often people on welfare have less good coverage. She didn't know many states that just didn't cover, welfare didn't cover organ donation, I mean organ transplantation, but they may be covered to a lesser degree and the financial burden on the recipient might be higher. She also did say that most of the transplant centers of which she's aware in this country, including all of them in Minnesota, have the option for providing the transplant free of charge to the recipient, but each center makes its own decisions about that on a case-by-case basis and only would provide that free for somebody in their catchment area. So the country's divided up on which transplant centers serve which parts of the country, generally speaking, and they would only serve people in their catchment area. Okay, so, and then the important thing to keep in mind as well is in organ donation, we have several really important parties to consider when we look at ethics, and that is not just the recipient, but the donor as well, and the transplant team, broadly defined as the doctors, nurses, psychiatrists, social workers, other therapists, other folks who do the work of making decisions with people about appropriateness. Yes?
Two things I don't think I heard you mention on the waiting list criteria was life expectancy afterwards. For instance, if a person's expected to have another 4 years or
she five did not
years.
Say that that was one of the criteria. That is likely considered when we're trying to balance, as we'll get into, the burden and the benefit for the recipient and the donor. How likely is this to work? And we'll get into that in our case big time. She said these are the three.
And Mary mentioned the contrast with Britain.
Right.
Therefore, that is a deciding criteria.
Right. Right. Age is a deciding criteria.
And the other thing I was wondering whether it was considered was kind of the culpability, maybe you could put it, of why that organ's failing. You know, a liver, you might need a liver because you got hepatitis or because you drank a quart a day. Mm-hmm. And I don't
it's
know.
It's not part of the criteria, but it certainly is part of the psychosocial assessment of the donor and the recipient. Yep.
And there's debate about whether or not it should be. Somebody, I mentioned this morning, but some of you may remember about 4 or 5 years ago when Mickey Mantle needed transplant, and it was because of alcoholism. He had really damaged his liver severely through cirrhosis, and people said, you know, if you brought this along through voluntary behavior, of course that raises questions, is it voluntary, is it addiction, all those kinds of things. But at this point, that kind of, you know, question has not been one of the deciding criteria.
Status is definitely a criteria. It's unwritten.
Status as in?
The recipient.
Class, race,
you
gender,
you
wealth,
bet.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah, it's not a formal criteria.
But it's there.
Right.
Refute this statement. I don't sense that there is a strong national movement. You talk about the shortage of organs to be donated. I think there's an overage of people dying, but I don't see any organization like Mothers Against Drunk Driving to organize the situation to alleviate this shortage. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I'll refute it for you, Dean. except I will bring back to Susan the fact that you haven't really heard about an organized effort. I mean, these UNOS organizations are working hard, but what they do is work through legislatures, and here are two examples. We are a state-by-state country, are we not? States' rights are very important, so this is going to differ by state. But right now, 25% of the states in this country allow organ procurement from people who have suffered cardiac death. And it used to be, and in the other 25 states, only people who have suffered brain death could have their organs procured. Now, we could get into the differences between the two, but saying somebody suffers a heart attack or their heart stops because of their other physical things, we can now procure those organs, which really multiplied the number of organs. Okay, but that was state legislatures that had to make decisions. Secondly, all of us, I think in all of our states, can put on our driver's license, I want to be an organ donor. In general, what that meant in most states, up till very recently, in Minnesota now included, it meant that if I had that on my organ, on my driver's license, I died, cardiac death or brain death, the transplant team comes in and asks my husband, we understand Mary was interested in being a donor, may we procure her organs? He could say no, and they wouldn't. They couldn't. Now he can say no, and they still can. So it is a legal directive now, even though I have died in many, many states, including Minnesota. And as Dan mentioned this morning, was it New Jersey that tried to have the
Pennsylvania,
the default position in law be, if you died, your organs were available for transplantation
unless
you said, I don't want them to be.
Before you died.
That didn't go, so it's not happening. But, you know, we're pushing in legislatures, so that's the only way I would refute it.
But there's a difference between having legislation and having people aware of it and actually doing
public
it.
Public education.
And let me, you brought up one thing that I think is pretty interesting and ironic when you brought up Mothers Against Drunk Driving, because interestingly, if you think about all of these as public health issues, introduction to Mothers Against Drunk Driving, introduction of airbags, everything that has reduced accident fatality rates in motorcycle helmet laws, all these things, ironically, have aggravated the shortage of organs.
They have kept the gun control laws
because you need a larger number of victims to have more available, and anything that reduces that, ironically, aggravates this problem. So it just, you know, one of those unintended consequences, I think, is something we still want. But
there is an organization in the Black community trying to educate the community about stem cells.
You know what's called and where?
I don't remember what it's called, but I do remember reading something about it at school. There was an organization that was out there trying to educate the community about the need.
There are lots of grassroots groups. I don't think they have the visibility of some of the other national organizations, but we should probably move along because we want to get you some time to really consider the case today, which is going to bring a lot of these different elements
in
there.
So we're passing the case off.
What I'd say first, let's get everybody in their groups right now so we can get you in groups. We want people in groups of four or five, and you can self-organize that. And if you're a non-group person, you have the option of sitting out, but we want to encourage you to meet your neighbors.
You're a lot of fun here, but
this group
I
use. Everybody has the case? Okay, we're going to, if you can redirect your attention from the case to me. So I always do with my students, the minute you give a handout, you've lost control of the class. But if you'll take your eyes off the case for just a moment here. This is a case that Mary and I both have direct experience with. And so we're going to do it a little bit differently than we've done before. Particularly Mary's experience of this has shaped in particular ways. So I'm going to read the case, and then we're going to do step one of the model together. That is gathering relevant facts and information. But Mary is going to present it through the voice of Barbara Jennings. So we have Barbara in our presence today, so you can ask her directly for any further information you need to know about her situation in order to get the information you need to make decisions about the case. The other thing, caveat we're going to do is that each of you are going to represent a somewhat different constituency, and we'll introduce your constituency after we've read the case over, so that may or may not affect how you think about the case as well. But let's read it over together here, and then we'll do step one of the model together. Barbara Jennings was referred to the University of Minnesota Hospital for her first pancreas transplant. She was 36 years old and had had insulin-dependent diabetes for 25 years. The pancreas transplant was advised because of the progressive nature of her diabetes complications. She received the transplant, which was covered through her husband's employer. During the following 2.5 years, she did extremely well and her complications stabilized. Then her body rejected the pancreas and she became very ill. Barbara applied for a second pancreas transplant and again was granted approval. She underwent a second transplant. This transplant was not successful and the organ was removed several months later. Her diabetes progressed, her kidneys failed, and she began kidney dialysis, which continues at present. She and her husband have since divorced. Recently, Barbara requested a kidney transplant. She also asked for another pancreas transplant to be done simultaneously. Without a new pancreas, a kidney transplant will not be helpful, and Barbara will be on dialysis until diabetes complications take her life. The question we want to consider is whether Barbara should be able to be eligible for, should she get, the third pancreas and the kidney.
And who should pay for it.
How old is she?
Barbara's 36.
Yeah, actually, she's 36 the first one, now she's, yeah, 40.
Do you have children?
Two children I have.
How old are they?
10 and 6. And I'm the sole custody parent.
Could I ask your doctor a question? I'd like to know whether the fact that you've rejected two pancreases now means that you're more likely to keep on rejecting.
Yes. Yes, and they tell me there's a lot, there's not a lot of real specific data that will help me personally, except generally, each time you get an organ, your chance of it working is down because of the stress on the body and all these other things. And so I don't really get it, except that I have less and less chance of it being successful.
Dialysis is expensive. What would you guess? Yes, for a situation.
Well, I haven't looked at, lately at my bills because it's really overwhelming. And so I think it's around $15,000 to $20,000 a year just to keep me on the dialysis. And in
that's
our
an
area,
ongoing.
It's three times a week,
right.
Several hours each time I go in, and I live about an hour from the city. So sometimes I don't feel like I can drive myself. People have to drive me. It's expensive just that.
Just sustaining you.
Are you on welfare?
I am on welfare now, Minnesota Medical Assistance. Yeah.
What kind of shape was your pancreas in the first one that after 2.5 years was there rejection on your part, or was there? Because I had a friend that this happened to. She had the kidney and the pancreas. Mm-hmm. And it only took for 5 years, but they knew going in. I guess what happened to her was as soon as she got it, there was some rough go at the beginning, mm-hmm. and they said it just last 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, because I've had diabetes for so long, I generally was already compromised. And so I was really glad I had the one as long as I did. Whether it was just my body or there was something with the pancreas I got, I guess they've never been really clear with me about that. But it's probably part of both, and clearly I'm getting sicker.
The other thing happened to this friend is she was on a list for the kidney, but not the pancreas. And is not dead.
Yeah.
So you need both.
Yeah.
If you stay on insulin and dialysis, what's your projected lifespan?
You know, they won't really tell me that. They will say, I won't stay at this level of health into the foreseeable future. But the longer I'm on dialysis, the less healthy I am in general. But I don't really get exactly why and what that's about, except I just assume when they take out all my fluids and clean them out and stick them back in, that can't be all that good for me. But they won't say, you know, if you just keep doing this, you'll have 5 more good years where you can keep traveling back and forth, and then you'll be, in bad shape or you'll die, or 10. People live on dialysis for a long time, lots of years, but they haven't told me exactly how long that will be, and I do worry about that.
Sir, two-part question about the kids. How are they doing? And if you were to die, what happens to them? Will they go to their father? Is he capable of taking care of them? So it's about 4 questions.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about that a lot because it's really painful. I'm trying to think about what will happen when I die, but it's really hard to do. And my kids know that I'm sick, but I'm still, managing fairly well. They're pretty little. My daughter's 6, and she feels sad when I don't feel good. Their dad is okay. I don't think that they shouldn't go to him. But he and I haven't worked that out or talked about it. We don't talk very much about my possible death. I really just want to live. I want to be there for my kids. So that's why I'm questioning.
Do you have any in-home services?
I haven't needed a lot yet. I have some really supportive friends and family that they check in, but because my first pancreas did really well, I even went back to work for a while. The second one, well, that was worse, and I was sick for quite a while. I was still married at the time, so my husband was around. I might need more now, more in-home care. I'm on MA because I can't work. I'm too sick to work. So I am on medical assistance.
What are your doctors telling you generally about the idea of getting a third transplant? requested.
It's the only way I'll live, at least for any good length of time with some quality, and they can't say for sure. But it's not just me asking for it. I mean, I have doctors who say, well, yeah, you're a candidate for, and you need both of these in order to make it worthwhile.
I have a question for the doctor, I guess, but if an alternative person who needed kidneys got those kidneys, would they, you know, is that a less serious thing? Would they have a much more likely success?
You mean if somebody only needed a kidney and doesn't need
exactly.
a kidney and pancreas? Oh, yeah. If I were completely healthy and this was my first transplant and I needed both, the chance of my surviving a year is about 80% with both. Mm-hmm. But if you get a kidney transplant, chance of survival is much higher than that and for much longer. So, yeah, there is, I suppose there's a question, if somebody over here just needs a kidney, why should I get it with a pancreas? I think we should
talk. I have one more question.
Yeah, one more information. Or no. Yeah.
Is organ replacement on the list of things that the state welfare's medical system supports?
I haven't pushed that yet. I haven't found out about whether medical assistance is going to cover this for me or not. I think I'm the first person in Minnesota who's tried to get an additional one. But I'm not sure. I haven't asked. I have social workers helping me with that.
Whatever that is.
All right.
Small groups.
You can see some questions that's at the bottom of your case there. We'd like you to consider those questions. And I'm going to hand out a situation for each of your groups to think about that perspective there, how you address it from that. And we'll go for 15 minutes or so, in the 10, 15 minutes in small groups. So.
And just for some difference, you're each
here?
Different constituents.
Each of your different constituents here.
And we're not going to announce what they are. Yep.
Here's our members of our first
Everybody's first name.
Yeah. So it's
a
the environment.
No, but I mean, he does have.
If he does, you also have to go, sure, get that. Or the library is the one that you are, but then only the
Swain.
Hey, who?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
We're used to teaching in here.
80 or 90 minute class session. So this is forcing us to as well, but thank
you. All right, what we'd like to do, we're going to poll the groups just to get some of the information out here along these categories here. We'd like you not to mention your group identity yet. We'll come back at the end and ask you who you are representing. We just want to get a sense of things. And the first thing we want to do is just go group by group and go yes or no. Should Barbara get the organs or no?
Yes.
No reasoning, except we're going to go group by group.
Who's 1A?
Group 1A.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. 2A?
Probably not.
Okay.
But we're not totally sure.
Okay, 3A?
No.
Don't say who you are. 4A? No. 5A?
We were 3-2, yes.
Wonder who they are. Okay, 2B?
Yes, with reservations.
And 3B?
We don't have to decide.
Yes, you do.
Yes, you do. I know. I'll tell you why, but how would you say, General?
We don't have to decide.
Probably.
Unlikely.
Yes.
Okay.
That's classic. When you hear who they are, you'll know. Okay. Pays. 1A.
This is for Timmy, for anybody who said yes.
First. State.
Oh,
who pays for it?
State.
Finances, we're talking about. State. That means MA.
Yeah.
Okay.
And 5A. Those are the yes people in 5A. Who should pay?
2A?
State.
They're probably not. Yeah, the no's don't need to pay for it because they're not
allowed.
Oh, hello. No's, never mind. Okay.
So we just get the yeses. 2B?
Okay. 2B, who should pay for it?
State.
Okay, and 3B, if it's maybe, who should pay for it?
Maybe to stay.
Maybe. You know what the book of Revelation says about Luke?
Yes, I do.
Let me say one thing.
Remember who I am.
Stay here will matter because we're talking about medical assistance, which is a state-federal mix. So by state, we mean government, okay? Yeah. Tax dollars, and that will vary by state.
Now,
okay.
What we'd like to do is have you think about, and you may not have talked about this specifically, but if we were to ask you within your group, what was the most significant factor or factors? What are the relevant factors that guided your decision?
Let's see how many you can get up one at a time.
We're thinking primarily about these kinds of things, these ethical issues here, but you may have phrases.
Let's start at the bottom. 3B, what was your primary?
Re-election. Success.
3B?
What was it for?
I said re-election.
Re-election?
likelihood of success.
Okay. 2B, what was your primary?
No, it was likely.
She was a member of our church.
And what's the principle you're worried about?
What's the ethical issue? What's the ethical dimension? Why?
Respect for person.
Christian
love. Valuing life. Okay?
5A?
Who's 5A?
Did
you have a primary thing you stuck
We had the probability of the ethical principle. I think utility is one.
Utility, the relevant factor, okay? Yeah. Utility in what sense?
Utility relative to whether she was more deserving than a lot of other people.
Is this the best use of a scarce resource? Okay.
Okay. Good. 4A, anything?
I'll say utility.
Utility as well. Any others that we haven't put up?
Possibly
justice.
Okay. Justice. Utility and justice.
Say more about justice. Same.
Just the idea.
What's fair to the other people on the list?
Yeah. Okay.
A fair allocation of resources.
Fair allocation. Good. How about 3A, anything we haven't said?
We're still working on it.
That's a principle.
It's the third one.
Beneficence. Yeah, okay.
I'm confused. How is
beneficence for all the
utilities? Oh, then you're talking about probably utility. Yeah. Beneficence is only directly toward the individual, himself or herself. So we're probably talking, you're talking about utility, best use of resources from everybody involved.
Because there's probably no argument that it would benefit Barbara, is there?
No.
Okay. At least in the short term.
Yes, there is. No, yes.
All right, we'll get to that. Good. Who else? Let's see.
They got utility here.
Oh, 2A.
So 2A?
We're taking number 3, beneficence.
And honesty.
And that whole thing of whole being for her.
Okay. So you're saying it would not promote, you're saying probably not because it would not promote her whole well-being. Good. Interesting. All right.
And then how about 1A?
1A.
Anything different?
Justice?
Justice.
Right?
So you, this is interesting. You're saying because of justice, she should get it.
Yes.
This other group here is saying because of justice, should not get it. So we'll unpack that a little bit here.
And we talked about burden benefit quite a bit.
Who are you again up here?
Yeah.
Okay. Did anybody not see an ethical dilemma here? Did anybody say, I wonder why we're doing this?
Now, when we talk about an ethical dilemma, we see a conflict between ethical considerations here.
So what is it between? What's in conflict here?
We had a dilemma, but it doesn't fall. You can help clarify. As professionals on a team, we got hung up on whether we were, as social worker, psychiatrist, doctor, representing the interests of a client, that is, her interest, or whether we were some kind of neutral panel of experts who were just supposed to make a moral decision. So I think if we felt a dilemma, it was our faithfulness and loyalty to our patient or client as psychiatrist, doctor, etc., advocating her personal interests, or a broader sort of neutral ethical decision-making team. So that was a kind of dilemma.
And that particularly comes in also in terms of motive. What are motives involved in here? We'll take a look at that. In particular, your SID group is, I think, had some interesting ones on that.
Certainly, the other thing that we had to consider was, just by going through this process, we would learn more and hope to be able to do the next one better.
Yeah.
So we did have that.
So in a way, the
that's
greater,
a utility.
Good,
that's
yeah.
a greatest good.
But now, which group are you?
5A.
So you guys, it sounds like you're torn between the duty owed to Barbara, beneficence, promote her whole well-being, and the greater good.
Right.
Utility.
Well, actually, in some ways, two different concepts of utility.
Yes.
On the one hand, the utility of take a tough case so we can serve people better, or take an organ from somebody who won't do as much good as having that organ for someone else. So it's two different concepts.
It is, and this is a really important point, that many of these particular issues can be found on both sides of the decision.
Yeah.
They guide us, but they don't direct the outcome. They help us, and so you've got two notions of utility here. We'll see this in a minute here, but this is a group that's involved as the transplant team themselves. On the one hand, you want to take difficult cases to advance technology in order to improve the greater good over time. On the other hand, it's a scarce resource, and somebody else may be able to better use it there, so you've got different notions of utility.
Can I raise the question, though, whether you really can be neutral as a transplant team? Do you think you can be ethically neutral as the transplant team? I'm asking. I don't think you can be. We have another group in the group here who's ethically neutral, more ethically neutral. But I think the transplant team has motives. Beneficence to the patient, perhaps utility. I don't think you can be ethically neutral. So I'm just raising it. Okay, maybe we should see who else decides about a dilemma.
Sure.
Is there a different dilemma for any group?
Anybody else come across different dilemmas?
Spinoff, what happens to the kids? So where would you put that?
That is going to be a relevant factor. You know, if you're in... And you can look at that lots of different ways. How would you bring in the concern for the kids in terms of some of these we talked about?
Burden benefit
to the children.
Or society.
And if it's to society, you're talking about utility again, you know.
Burden benefit's Barbara. Barbara. So is this a burden or a benefit to Barbara? And that considers her children, doesn't it? She just wants to live.
Right.
She wants to see them grow up and take care of them. Yeah.
But does society have a vested interest in keeping children with a primary parent, those kind of things, or, you know, public support issues, those kind of things also come in.
But, you know, we had big questions about what appears to us as denial, having not considered what she's going to do with her children, not talking to her husband about it, not apparently making arrangements with another kind of a guardian, not wanting to check the bills. I mean, lots of different things that came up seemed to speak of a certain amount of denial. Not saying that's not normal, but...
But in other words, is she taking full responsibility in this situation?
That for somebody who has had diabetes since she was 11 years old, I mean, this is pretty much in your face.
Mm-hmm.
And
I would argue that the transplantation has evolved to such a state of expertise, that the psychosocial evaluation of the beneficiary, the recipient, really does take into account whole well-being, and they very carefully look at her social situation, her mental health situation, her spiritual situation. And as we made the argument even more in this morning's case, we're doing the same full assessment of donors, not just the recipients.
I understand that. I have a son-in-law who got a kidney transplant, again, from a family member. But again, you know, how long is Daryl going to live, and when will he need another transplant? And, you know, will Emily be 15, or will she be 20, you know?
Let's do this real quick. Let's identify who you are, and then we'll just open it up for broader discussion. If we're interested in seeing, does it make any difference in the way you evaluate an ethical issue from where you're located with respect to the situation?
1A is?
Immediate family.
Immediate family. And you said yes, she should get it. Okay?
No question.
All right?
2A?
Word of her church family.
All right. And you said probably not. And what was the reason, what, from a church family perspective, why?
Yeah,
I tried.
I think we said we would be supportive of her, whatever she would decide, we would say we love you, we want to help you. But if we sat back and thought about it, we thought it was more important for us to be helping her to come to terms with the situation, to say, you know, as Christian people, we can say the word death without falling down and just... Not doing anything. And we should be helping her to consider the children and to looking for people, others who have faced death or who are facing death with more confidence to become part of her.
And this is a really interesting point. This is why I think it's so important for church groups and to consider these kind of things ahead of time as much as possible, because when you're faced with the immediate crisis, it's more difficult. But imagine how torn you are as a church between the wider mission of the gospel, it's justice, and your love and concern for a particular member. What we oftentimes do in these kinds of things here too is really push for, let's think creative about all the different kinds of alternatives. You've raised some wonderful ones, helping Barbara come to terms with it. Letting her know that you will provide the support both for her and her children. Yeah, Dorothy.
I would say that even if we had decided yes, we still would be saying the most important thing is for her to come to terms with her finitude and to listen in a new way to the liturgy and to, you know, find some friends who are not just thinking that technologies are salvation.
Good. See, and
because
I
we're limited in time, I'm sorry to interrupt. Can we just get through what everybody else's is so we have a good sense?
Minnesota State Legislators.
Oh, that's why the heart was no.
Yeah. Oh, you remember
that. Utility.
Utility underlines all social policy decisions.
That's why we're right by the door.
Yeah. 4A is who?
We're a group of ethicists. So you have to listen to us.
So
yeah. You're completely objective.
Okay? 5 of us.
Oh, the medical team, the transplant team, yeah. Which is very interesting, a divided group on this one for several issues.
We had a problem, you know, we had a discussion with the two of them about who we were, whether it was just the medical team or whether it included the larger transplant team, meaning, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists, you know, social workers. So that's
a complex one.
To be as who?
Church.
Also. And then. Does that mean the same as 2A?
Yeah. Yes. And so
we have
two church groups.
And
they said probably yes.
Were there two immediate families? No. What's this group?
We're a legislators.
They're concerned for re-election. They're the
maybe. They said maybe, and the other one said no. Are you all from Minnesota? It sounds like Minnesota now.
Well. Yes, we thought our role is to, A, make sure that there is a reasonable prioritization scheme for people on the transplant list, and B, decide on the level of funding. And we're not the executive branch, and after that, somebody else's problem. I mean, to be crass about it. Mm-hmm.
If she's put high enough on the list by the people who do the rankings and the funding hasn't run out, we'll pay for it.
And interestingly, when we started this teaching, pancreas was considered experimental.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And MA had to be pushed by the state of Minnesota for Barbara.
And.
And then imagine.
Barbara took her case.
Third.
Barbara took her case public, which put a lot of pressure on the legislators because she brought her children out.
Re-election.
She showed them.
Was that
re-election. If they don't allow this to occur, I'm going to die and these children will be orphaned. I mean, you know, this is part of the reality of how this plays out.
Right.
And
so how did it come out?
I'm just looking for cover.
Do you know, I honestly don't know. I met Barbara in a ethics class that Ron Cranford, who's a neurologist in Minnesota, was holding, and James Nelson, who's a UCC minister, who's done a lot of writing on bioethics. She came to the class when she was waiting approval for her third dual organ transplant. And I've tried to find out what happened to her, and I haven't found out.
We, Mary and I did have an interesting time. We taught this case just a few times, but the first time we taught it, some people came in late, I think, when Mary was doing the role play, and they were fully convinced that this was the person who needed it. And it was really, I mean, it taught us a lesson about how to be careful about setting these up. But
she's
on the other hand,
room.
You know,
it's different.
It's
we're
very,
looking at Barbara.
Yeah.
We feel different.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
right.
That was actually something that I don't know if my team felt this way, but you know, we were supposed to be a group of ethicists who were coming to this from the outside, didn't know Barbara as a person. And so I felt like I was very abstracted in what I was thinking about. And yet, number one is respect for persons. I mean, I kept feeling the tension between, in order to come up with a decision, I have to somewhat abstract myself. On the other hand, Barbara's there, and Barbara can't be a unit or walked around or just a number. And so that was very hard for me to, I mean, I did come down on the no side, and I'm comfortable with that, but.
And this Barbara was white, educated, at the time married, insured, at least with MA, and felt competent to come in front of people and talk, and the legislature and talk, and imagine other people who don't. And there's a resource and justice issue as well.
We have to stop it. I mean, just a little last point. One of the reasons I find this such a helpful teaching case is because, despite our best efforts, where we're located in any situation influences how we see and how we analyze it. And it's really important for all of ourselves to know that. It makes a difference if I'm a family member, a church member, a public policy person, an expert brought in to try to be objective. All those things shape the way we do it. There's no right or wrong answer, but we're influenced by where we're located and the color of our skin, our education level, those things. So,
thank you very much. We're done.
Thank you.
Can you turn the tape off? We have handouts up here.